You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of November 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. My guests, Linda Yu and Jane Kinnamont, will be discussing the day's top stories, including Angela Merkel's very own coalition chaos as talks about a future government fall through. Then, it's official. The European Medicines Agency and the European Banking Authority will move out of London. But where to? We'll tell you all. All that, plus Robert Mugabe clings to power in Zimbabwe, and Saad Hariri takes his time to head back to Lebanon since he resigned. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guest today, Linda Yu, broadcaster and author of The Great Economists, and how their ideas can help us today. And Jane Kinnamont, who's the deputy head of the Middle East and North Africa programme at Chatham House. Welcome both back to the show. We start today's programme with a look at Germany, where the talks about forming a coalition have collapsed. For the past month, Chancellor Angela Merkel has been immersed in talks with three other parties, the Free Democrats, Christian Social Union and the Greens. While the Social Democrats, the second biggest party in the last election, have ruled out forming a coalition with Merkel's Christian Democrats. So what are their prospects for forming a government now? Jane, we'll start with you. We should unpack really why this has fallen apart, this notion of a new coalition. And it seems one of the biggest touch points is still, after all this time, migration, what the numbers should be and how Germany can be an inclusive society, but also one that can deal with the level of migration it's been facing.
Absolutely. Angela Merkel was admired by many around Europe for taking this kind of moral leadership stance, but she's paid an enormous price for it because it has divided her own party over the treatment of refugees in particular and the coalition. And the rest of Europe does have some responsibility for that because others were not willing to really step up and share what they saw as a massive refugee burden. So while we are seeing this kind of anti-migration and sadly anti-refugee sentiment in many places, it's not something that's totally inevitable. If you'd had a stronger kind of collective leadership across Europe, it would have been easier. Instead, she was left quite exposed as people asked, why are we doing the majority of this? Why doesn't the rest of Europe come with us?
Now, there has been some suggestions putting a kind of cap on the numbers, which it seems that she was willing to go along. So that, again, it's one of these odd debates between numbers in a way. But it also makes you wonder whether many of the coalition partners are looking over their shoulders, concerned that, you know, one of the parties is not in the coalition is obviously Alternative for Deutschland. Mm. But they know that these very far right parties did incredibly well in the last round of elections. And they also want to make sure that they don't lose any more votes to them.
Absolutely. And there is a risk when you go back to elections so soon that voters are basically annoyed that they have to vote again, that the turnout might well be lower, that more people might go for a protest vote. So Merkel has been saying today she would rather have early elections than a minority government, but she may be hoping that the fear of early elections will galvanise the other parties to come together, which seems to be what the president will be pushing for in the coming days.
Well, we might come back to that because it's interesting. Lots of, even the Alternative for Deutschland seem to be keen on new elections. When we look at the kind of international impact of this, obviously, one of the things we're concerned about is, you know, Merkel is the leading force in Europe, and, you know, sitting here in the UK, you know, we're concerned about the staggering, slow-moving Brexit negotiations. Do you think, Linda, there's a concern that they will not go, well, they're not going well now, but they will continue to go in a slow, sluggish form if she cannot be seen as a powerful leader?
I think there's some fear of that. especially since Michel Barnier, the EU negotiator, he really has limited delegated authority. And so in one sense, even though the EU says that Britain will not be negotiating individually with the EU 27 countries, it's pretty apparent that Angela Merkel, if she can form a government, and Emmanuel Macron have an outsized say in terms of how the Eurozone will evolve. So I think there's going to be quite a lot of interest in terms of watching whether or not there might be an early election, whether or not she keeps a minority government with a supply and confidence agreement, something that Britain has, or whether or not the German president's exhortations will lead Martin Schulz, who leads the Social Democrats, to come to the table. And even though they've said they won't join in another grand coalition with the CDU, Merkel's CDU, maybe president says they should be thinking about their duty to the people and come to the table. I don't know how likely that is. Remember, the SPD were pretty burned the last time they were in a grand coalition with the CDU and the CSU. They didn't do very well after that, in the first election afterwards. So, but I think overall, this uncertainty hasn't really rattled a lot of people around Brexit or the markets, because Germany is still seen as a fairly stable parliamentary system. And I suppose the thinking is they'll sort it.
And not for today, but do you think if, you know, there's a difficulty pulling together a successful government around Merkel, there'll be concern in Paris? Because we have Macron voted into power on this belief that he will bring reform and change the very nature of the EU. He's kind of ready for the UK to leave so he can get on with the business of, you know, Germany and France leading Europe again. But if he's left with the only one with an effective, you know, kind of, you know, mandate, again, would that... And that then affects everyone in the EU. If they can't begin to reform and shake up the way things are done, many other people may become disappointed and disenfranchised from the project.
Yeah, I think Macron needs Angela Merkel to realize his vision for the Eurozone, which is more integration once Britain leaves. One of the biggest, you could say, obstacles to further integration, especially in terms of fiscal policy, will not be there. But I suppose looking at what could happen in terms of Angela Merkel, it's quite true the migration crisis has obviously dented her popularity. And if you look at the top 10 nations which take in the most refugees, the only one which is a country not in crisis or embroiled directly in the region is actually Germany. And so I think from that perspective, she does have this weakness on her right flank, as you point out, with the AfD entering parliament. About 10% of the parliamentarians in the Bundestag is going to be from this far-right party. So I think in that sense, Merkel is already a little bit less strong, I suppose, of a European leader, because her electorate has been fracturing, whereas Macron actually has a fairly strong mandate. So this is pretty unlikely, but it's just possible that Macron, with his charismatic vision and whatever it is, that however you want to describe the movement behind him, so long as either France or Germany takes a lead, I imagine that the European project will probably still proceed. But obviously, one nation rather than two leading it makes it much harder to make progress on that front.
Jane, what do you think about the engine for change if it's not got Mrs. Merkel at the front of the bus?
We'll see more opportunities for small states within the European Union, I think, if we're seeing Britain on its way out and potentially Germany being more consumed with domestic politics. Then I think a number of other European states would actually jump at the ability to have more of a say within Europe. It might be a bit more complex, but not necessarily a terrible thing.
Well, that's what's happening at the moment in the negotiations over the EU. But we also wanted to dive into another story which is directly connected with this, which is in Europe, the inevitable topic is Brexit has forced two of the key big agencies to up sticks and move. That's the European Medicines Agency and the European Banking Authority. And today they've been voting on who will get to have those agencies in their various cities. And since we've been watching the vote during the day, it has been announced that the European Medicines Agency is going to be heading to Amsterdam. And we understand that perhaps in the next 5 or 6 minutes, we may get to hear who has picked up the EBA. It looks like Frankfurt is in the lead there, but Paris is still in the running too. How important do you think this is, Linda, the departure of these two organisations? And what does it mean for both Amsterdam and potentially Frankfurt if they get them?
Mm. I think it's going to be quite a boon to those cities because the headquartering of these major agencies doesn't just involve skilled jobs. So the EMA, for instance, employs about 900 highly skilled, scientifically, experienced workers. It's also all the companies that come along to visit them at their headquarters. That generates quite a lot of traffic, business travel, and what have you. So having these in these cities, that's why these countries have been vying for them to have. And I suppose for London, it's a fairly inevitable consequence of Brexit. If Britain is no longer in the European Union, and these agencies are European Union institutions charged with a regulatory role, I suppose it really wouldn't make much sense for them to stay in a country that's no longer part of the single bloc.
And Jane, if the Germans, for example, get the EBH, as I said, we'll hear hopefully in the coming minutes, that would be a huge boost for Frankfurt's attempts to be the banking alternative to London.
Absolutely, because it will be seen by them as a sign of bigger things to come. On the other hand, London has never pitched itself only as a European-facing financial centre. It is a major centre for global banking. It has a strong niche in Islamic finance and so forth. So the financial sector, you know, maybe one of the less vulnerable sectors to Brexit. Not everyone agrees with that, but it's less European oriented than quite a lot of our goods trade.
I'm just getting a message through that is telling me that Frankfurt is out of the running. So does that leave it with Dublin, I believe, and Paris? Yeah. Dublin and Paris are the two that are kind of left in the running. So a surprise move there, because I think many people thought that Frankfurt would do very well. In the first round of voting, Paris had 34 votes, Frankfurt 32 and Dublin 28. So Paris, again, another one of these cities, Jane, very keen to pick up the mantle of London from the city. And again, with Macron in power, he's really gone out to kind of make the capital appealing. So again, good for Paris.
It's reversing what's been the trend of recent years with many, many French bankers coming to work in London, although the work-life balance in Paris might be more appealing to many people on a human level, but doesn't quite fit with a lot of international banking practices.
Well, what's interesting, Linda, that's not an irrelevant point. I understand that today when the decision was made for the EMA to go to Amsterdam, there was a lot of cheering, and many people who are in same-sex marriages were delighted, because many of the cities on the very long list have been places that don't recognise those unions. So actually, quality of life and how you get treated, and also, interestingly, Amsterdam is a city where you can do everything in English. So even like the poor English staff here in the UK is an easy place for them to transfer to. Quality of life is important, I guess, in these votes as well, certainly for the staff.
Yes, and actually, I think I read that the EMA staff overwhelmingly said they'd rather stay in London. But of course, the general point is true. I think what's interesting about Paris edging out Frankfurt, it looks like, and of course, Dublin is still in the running to head the EBA, is that one of the reasons why the EBA was in London, rather inside the Eurozone, is because there. Of all the countries in the EU, there's still about 10 countries which are not part of the Eurozone. So the EBA is intended to oversee the banking union and then this new capital markets union. And so that gives it scope to cover the EU 28 or soon to be EU 27. That's actually quite separate to what the ECB does, which is to increasingly gain regulatory authority over the banking system of the European Union. They have what's now called the SSM, which is a single supervisory mechanism. So I suppose one reason why perhaps votes are going for Paris instead of Frankfurt is that it keeps up this duality of a Eurozone, which is proceeding to integrate, but they still have to somehow regulate and bring together the non-Euro countries, which are in the EU, and still need to have some degree of institutional development for them to be able to, as it were, all get along. And Sweden is the biggest example this, actually, outside of the UK as a non-Euro EU country. So I suppose that might be one of the ways that people who are voting are thinking about it. But yes, it is a big boost to Paris if it should get it.
And Jane, on that same topic, how... how significant is it, do you think, for these teams that they get some say in where they end up? Do you think that if you were choosing, where would you choose, Paris or Dublin, if you're casting your vote next?
Oh, fabulous. I definitely wouldn't choose Frankfurt.
Okay.
But I wouldn't mind Berlin. I just came back from a weekend there where I totally avoided politics and enjoyed the nightlife.
Good. Well, we're going to move on in a moment. But for now, a short break.
Who's up, who's down, and who's out? As the world begins to hunker down for the holidays, we unwrap our annual Soft Power Survey and much more in Monocle's bumper December-January double edition. In a tumultuous year for global politics, we play snakes and ladders with the world's soft power rankings, revealing whose worsening image abroad has seen them take a downward slide and which nations on the charm offensive are climbing to success. We also visit a tiny country with a rich history, San Marino, the world's oldest republic and a nation proud to defend its traditions, crossbow in hand. Next, we grab our first-class tickets, head to our favourite airline lounge and jet into Monocle's annual Travel Top 50. From revamped modernist hotels to the best new high-speed trains, we pack a year's worth of travel highlights into this comprehensive survey. Our voyage continues into the inner workings of National Geographic in our culture pages as we take a peek behind that famous yellow border to see how one of the world's most coveted print titles remained relevant in an ever-changing world. The best is saved until last for you this festive season as our inventory pages unveil Monocle's Christmas gift guide featuring 200-plus present suggestions. From wine and cheese to technology and tools, there's something in here for even the finickiest of friends and family. Monocle's December-January issue is out now. Get your copy today or subscribe at monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House. Here with me, Andrew Tuck, Linda Yu and Jane Kinnamont. Zimbabwe's Robert Mugabe has ignored today's noon deadline to offer his resignation, which was imposed by the country's ruling party. It was much expected that he would resign in a televised address last night, but instead he vowed to stay on as Zimbabwe's president. Jane, did you watch that address?
I haven't actually seen it, but the whole theatre of it really reminds me of Egypt 2011 when Hosni Mubarak was expected by everyone to resign and he stood up and he made this televised speech which everyone watched. I was watching it from Beirut at the time and he didn't resign. And then the next day his vice president announced his resignation on his behalf.
Now we understand that in somewhere like the States impeachment would take like 4 years, but they seem to have an express service potentially available in Zimbabwe. Some people are claiming he could be impeached and gone within 2 days. Is that what you, looking at the situation, think will happen next, or do you think we're in for a long slog here?
This is really uncertain. The constitution has been designed to protect the president and make him very difficult to remove. And he is a lawyer by training. He will, if he's desperate to cling on to power, he will be using lots of legal arguments. But at the end of the day, it is a military regime. They do have the power also to change the rules of the game. I think the military will just be trying to calculate how can they get him to go in a dignified way. They clearly want to avoid doing something that would be labelled a coup by the South African Development Community and by the African Union and so on, and they want to
because
give
then in
a graceful
theory then
exit.
In theory those neighbours would have to step in and do something, wouldn't they?
It could potentially lead to sanctions and so forth. I mean, the African Union called the 2013 coup in Egypt a coup when others didn't, but ultimately they got over it. But I think there is that desire to sort of preserve some sense of dignity for the man who has been their post-independence leader for all this time, but is now the oldest head of state in the world, and at 93, you know, really has lost a lot of the support that he had, even within his own party. And that's what's fascinating about this. Despite all the domestic opposition and the foreign opposition to Mugabe, it's ultimately his own inner circle and his own military that will be the ones to remove him whenever exactly that takes place.
Linda, much of the prism we're watching the story through is the notion that if he goes, then the West will step in with money and, you know, Zimbabwe will be back on its feet in no time. But actually, the narrative seems to have moved on in many ways. Do the Zimbabweans care whether, you know, the UK likes them or not? Because their money and their support has often come from China in recent years. Is it more important what's thought in Beijing than what's thought of in London at the moment?
Yeah, possibly. I think they probably care more about what their neighbors think. I was recently in Kenya, and obviously it's another country which is experiencing some political turmoil. And it's increasingly the case, I think, that Chinese money is there, Western influence is still there. But ultimately, I think it's a continent that feels a bit more confident than before. But I mean, the whole Robert Mugabe non-resignation speech, the coup that is a non-coup, it is all just, I think, theater at this point. I think the reality is this man has run the Zimbabwean economy into the ground. And the reason why his people and his party have now turned against him and a continuation of his policies via his wife, Grace. She was expelled from ZANU-PF, and the vice president that he expelled was named the new head of ZANU-PF. And Morgan Tsvangirai is even talking about re-entering the political fray, the opposition leader. So I think if they can get some type of political competition, true political competition going, I think that probably would be the best outcome for this country. And let's not forget, Zimbabwe has huge potential. It was the breadbasket of Africa soon after independence. Mugabe's been there for 37 years. The first years of his presidency, it's a long time ago, Zimbabwe was doing well post-independence. But then, as with a lot of these kinds of autocrats, over time, they began to go downhill, the 80s, the 90s, until recently were between hyperinflation and massive degrees of, I think, economic distress. I suppose one might even wonder why it's taken this long for him to be removed. Is that quite right? Since he didn't resign, it's not a coup.
Importantly, he also managed to alienate the Chinese over business, because last year he nationalised Zimbabwe's diamond mines, and a couple of them were half owned by Chinese companies. Now, it seems that basically diamond revenues have been disappearing for a long time due to corruption within the security services and the ruling elite who control those diamonds. But because he saw that the treasury was running low on diamond revenues, he blamed the diamond companies and nationalised them all. And so here, interestingly enough, you have China preferring others in ZANU-PF who they see as more investment friendly, because in a way China has become more like a Western style power which is interested in countries who are open to foreign investment, at least as long as it comes from China.
What do you think are the prospects, Jane, though, for turning this country around? Because, you know, we've both said that, you know, here's lots of really good things that the country has potentially going for it. But oddly, when you watched last night the lineup of generals beside Mugabe, you know, here's a group of people who apparently want him to go, and they looked as exhausted as he does. It didn't look like a dynamic team waiting to take over. Is it almost a generational thing that, you know, power needs to move to people 20, 30 years younger?
Well, people are making that argument, including in the opposition movement for democratic change, because Morgan Tsvangirai also is not as old, but older and in ill health. But I think the politics will take a long time to get right, not least because there will be very high expectations in the opposition that now is their time, while ZANU-PF leaders are saying, no, this is our business. We need a new leader from inside our party.
Where is Saad Hariri? After abruptly resigning as Lebanese president while in Saudi Arabia last week, his whereabouts have been anywhere but in Lebanon. He's now in France at the invitation of President Emmanuel Macron, where he announced that he would be going to Cairo next before heading back to Beirut later this week. Linda, what's he up to?
I don't think anyone knows. Well, he made this abrupt announcement that he was resigning as prime minister from Saudi Arabia on November the 4th. And then he subsequently has said, while in Paris, he will return to Lebanon this week. And he'll be speaking on his own television station. But I suppose a couple of the suspicions is that, did he make these statements voluntarily? Is he influenced by the Saudis? Two of his children remain in Saudi Arabia. But he did show that his oldest son, who's studying in Britain, was free to travel and joined him and his wife for lunch in the Elysee Palace. So I suppose this is one of the more intriguing stories I've seen. And of course, the Lebanese president hasn't accepted the prime minister's resignation either.
So General Ouna said, you know, we'll see how you feel when you get back to Beirut. Do you think it's a resignation he's going to insist on sticking to? Because even like
Every player, it seems, in Lebanon suddenly really loves him and wants him to stay in place because of the very complicated network, Patrick Howe government is put together in Lebanon, where every distinct religion and organisation has their own person in government.
I think he has to resign to maintain any kind of credibility, but the president is not bound to accept his resignation. The president could re-nominate him again, or what might well happen is Lebanon staggers on without a prime minister for weeks or even months while
Parliament
rouses.
It's gone very long before.
That's the thing, is that life goes on in Lebanon. You know, people do have a way of coping with government dysfunction because that is the norm and people get on with things. But there is clearly a deep anxiety at the moment at the prospect of having had the Prime Minister resign while many reports have suggested he was basically under some kind of de facto house arrest in Saudi Arabia. Lebanon is a country that's lacked effective sovereignty for a long time, but this is just making it more and more obvious. And of course, many people in Lebanon are afraid of, you know, what will be next in terms of Saudi pressure. Again, you know, there is an element of political theatre to all this resignation or not resignation, but a lot of the concerns of ordinary Lebanese people will be about, does Saudi Arabia put really heavy economic pressure on Lebanon next? Many Lebanese people work in Saudi Arabia and in the Gulf. It's an absolutely vital source of investment and remittances and so forth. Already the Gulf countries are telling their citizens not to go and travel to Beirut. And of course, partying Gulfies are one of the major engines of Lebanese economic growth over the summer. And so it's an anxious time.
While this Hariri's decision is a symbol of that kind of tumultuous nature of Lebanese politics, as Jane says, in the end, nothing is going to be resolved until there's some resolution between Tehran and Riyadh, is it?
Yeah, I think quite a lot of what's happening in Lebanon is heavily influenced by what's happening in the region, even though I think Lebanon has been for some time trying to stand apart, as it were, from especially the tensions between the Saudis and the Iranians. And I suppose one of the issues around Saad Hariri is that his father, I believe, used to be prime minister.
Yeah.
His father was assassinated. And so I do think this goes back quite a long ways. But having seen what's been happening in Lebanon since at least the 1980s, they are used to a high level of dysfunction, as Jane says, for lack of a better word. So I suppose they will plow on, but I think they are in between, probably a proxy battle by the other major powers in the region. And perhaps this very odd political incident is just the latest manifestation of Saudi becoming a lot more assertive in terms of the region and still the very significant influence of Iran.
And just on that Saudi question, is difficult for us to get our heads around exactly what's happening there, because one minute we're in here reporting on, you know, women being allowed to drive, you know, crack down on corruption, crack down on religious police. You know, it feels like a country heading towards a kind of more reformist, a softer version of Islam. And then on the other hand, we have this very strong military edge to the country, which seems to contradict much of that with what's happening in Yemen. And now it's kind of more bullish attitude to stand up against Tehran.
Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia has given himself one of the world's most ambitious to-do lists. He sees no contradictions between these things. He thinks these are all things that Saudi Arabia should have been doing for the last 20 or 30 years. He's desperately trying to make up time. But the foreign policy adventurism is not exactly going to help him to attract the foreign investment, which is what he really needs for his domestic projects to succeed.
Well, there you hear it. That brings us to the end of today's show. My special thanks to Linda Yu and also to Jane Kinnamont. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Rabello, and it was researched by Gaia Lutz and also by Tom Melville. And our studio manager, well, that was Sarah Miles. From me, Andrew Tuck, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.